Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 17th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Cheryl Ney. Session number is 98-9 and is titled Genetics in the 20th Century, the Causes of Huntington's Disease and ALD. Let's listen in.
Of course, the DNA forensics thing is a huge example of genetics crossing the law, intersecting with the law. So, we have this category that we call organizational, which would include business, legal, political. All right, do we need laws to regulate genetics? We know this case where Richard Seed wants to clone human beings, right? Federal government said, we're not going to let that happen, right? So we've got political aspects to genetics. And then another category would be a category called cultural aspects. These would just be the ethical issues. They could be cross-cultural, right? Do people in Africa think about genetics differently than we do here in the United States? Right? There's probably some cultural differences. And so by having these three categories, we can now define this web of human activity. All right? So a web is a big sticky thing, and we need some ways to sort through the web, and we can use the categories of technical, organizational, and cultural aspects to do that. So let me illustrate that with the story of Huntington's disorder. Now I should say, if you have questions or comments, I know we have a lot of expertise in the room, a lot of different expertise, so I really do appreciate your questions and concerns as we move along. It kind of enriches the story just a little bit. All right. So let's now move to the case of Huntington's disorder. Is there anyone in the room who feels fairly comfortable with knowledge about Huntington's disorder? Does anybody know a family where Huntington's disorder exists? Sometimes you have to check these things out when I teach genetics to non-science majors. Sometimes you have to check because, you know, a student will come up to you after class and say, you know, I've got this crazy thumb in my family and it's passed on, or I had a cousin who died recently of cystic fibrosis. So sometimes you kind of have to check things out. All right, so let me try to set up the story because I do have a clip that I'd like to show you related to this story, a video clip. So I'm going to start the story from a very personal aspect, and that is from Huntington's disorder as it impacted the Wechsler family. And that, I've got a timeline down here, and that story starts in 1968, because that's the year that Alice's mother, Lenore, is diagnosed with Huntington's disease. At that point, Alice is about 26 or 27, so she's a young woman. She's lived in the family, you know, grew up in this family where they didn't know that they had this trait. And what's very strange about this is that Lenore was very highly trained in genetics. She got a master's degree at Columbia University in the 30s, working in the lab of T.H. Morgan, who was one of the great granddads of genetics. So here is a woman who herself was a geneticist and did not realize that this trait that was in her family was A, genetic, and B, it could be passed on through male and female. There was sort of a family legend that there was some kind of male trait that was passed on. So it's very, to Alice, of course, looking back, it's very hard for her to understand how her mother could work in genetics and yet not understand this herself. So there's Alice, who's about 27. There's Lenore, who's been diagnosed. Alice has a younger sister, Nancy, who's about 3 years younger. She's 23 at this time, Nancy Wexler. And also in this family unit, there's an ex-husband that Milton Wexler has divorced Lenore by this time. And that's, of course, due to the slow decline of Lenore, that Huntington's disorder starts as really just depression. And apparently this causes a rift in the family, and earlier, before the diagnosis, Milton has already divorced Lenore, but he's very close still with Nancy and Alice. All right, so this diagnosis comes as it's really kind of a defining moment for the life of this family. Let me tell you a little bit about the disorder. It's estimated that currently about 30,000 people in the United States have the disorder, and 150,000 people are at risk for it. So it's pretty rare, but if you're one of the 30,000, it doesn't matter if it's rare, right? What's interesting, there are two really interesting things about this disorder. It's what's called a dominant disorder. And so all you have to have is one copy of the trait. So if the trait is in your family line, if your mother's line or your father's line has it, and if either your mother or your father have it, and you get it, and you get the trait, you just need one copy. So what that means for children is every child born in that family has a 50-50 chance of inheriting the disorder. So it's even worse than cystic fibrosis. You have to have two copies. That's a recessive. You have to have two copies. So that's a 1 in 4 chance. So every family born in a cystic fibrosis family has every child has a 1 in 4 chance. For this disorder, it's 50-50. So now you can imagine what happens to Alice and Nancy in 1968 when they had this diagnosis. That means this disorder is in their line, and each of them has a 50-50 chance of inheriting this disease. And furthermore, it's an adult onset disease. So you may not know till you're 30, 40, 50 that you have this disease. So in 1968, at this moment of the diagnosis, Alice and Nancy are facing the question of, do I have it? Does my sister have it, but I don't have it? You know, this kind of sibling problem that would be set up, sort of sibling guilt that would be set up if your sister got it, but you didn't. So it's a pretty, because it's dominant and because it's adult onset, that's bad. But what's worse is it's a neurodegenerative disorder. So it's a gradual decline, starting with depression. Then you begin to lose motor control, and that's the chorea part. And then you just slowly go into dementia, and you start to lose more and more motor control. And it's really a very, very nasty, very nasty ending. Apparently a lot of nursing homes don't want to take HD patients in later stages. And in fact, this is a problem for Lenore Wexler. So it's really not, it's not a nice disease on top of it being dominant and adult onset. And we're gonna see some clips here of some Venezuelan families that have the trait. So I think you'll get a better sense of the disorder. Any questions or comments about the disease?
Why are these a Venezuelan family?
We're going to get to that here pretty soon. What has happened is there's a small fishing community on a lake on a remote, isolated lake. And by having a small community, it's inbred, and hopefully they're going to be able to find the gene by using samples from this family. I was trying to think of what the analogy might be to Holden, and perhaps it's the religiosity gene that's in high concentration here. So we're going to bring in a team of geneticists to check that out. I don't know. I'm sorry, you had a question.
That's okay. What are the implications for the Lenore's grandchildren? Nancy and Lenore?
Right. If Nancy or Alice have it, then each of their children has a 50-50 chance. Just
so
keeps going right on down the family line. They have to worry about whether or not to have children. And in fact, Nancy decides never to have children. And at one point in the story, Alice is trying to figure out whether or not she wants to have children. And the other part about it is, it gets worse, there's no good treatment. Right? Even to this day, there's no good treatment. There's a lot of little things that you can do to treat different aspects of it, but there is no good treatment. So, I mean, that's pretty amazing considering what medical science can do. They can't do very much for this particular disorder. All right, so that's how it hits Alice's family, and I think for those of you who have expertise in families, you can just imagine. And one thing Alice does that's very nice in this book is that now she goes back and tries to reread her life, understanding that her mother had this illness the whole time. And it's really, what I find for students is, it's really kind of cathartic. It really helps raise the idea of what secrets lurk in families and the impact of disease. You know, I have a lot of students who wonder about alcoholism in their family or heart disease or what have you. So she does a really nice job of using her own life experience to kind of reflect on what the impact is. Well, you don't know that that's what's going on, you know. So it's the first couple chapters are very nice in that regard. So they really bring in some cultural aspects of this particular disorder. Let me just say a few words about the history of this disease that Alice has brought to us, because it really brings up important issues about just disease in general in society. So let me just tell you about what she discovered about Huntington's disease. It wasn't until the turn of the century that the disease is characterized as genetic. Because of course, we didn't have a whole lot of understanding about genetics till late 1800s and on into the turn of the century. So it's not labeled a genetic disorder until about 100 years ago. So imagine if you were a family in the 1700s or 1800s, there wouldn't be this genetic tie to it. And of course, you'd be having kids, and because you don't know you're going to have the disease till you're 50. So you'd think that you'd, by the time you were, childbearing age in the 1800s, you'd think that you weren't going to get it, and then there was no tie to genetics. So how did people explain it? Well, you can imagine. Imagine being in a community in the 1800s or 1700s or 1600s, and you see people who are shaking. So the shakes was the name for the disease, or the fidgets. I noticed they used that for Narnia the other day. They wondered about the fidgets. Fidgets was a label for this disease. Mad staggers was another label. And it's interesting that in the 1600s in North America, in the colonies, in the U.S. colonies, the disease was often attributed as a curse to those who persecuted Roger Williams. So there's a very interesting example of politicizing a disease. And there's also sort of a religious element there, because, of course, Roger Williams was a religious dissident. So it was politicized here in the U.S. early on. Alice traces the disease all the way back to 16th century Norway. So there is documentation that the disease has been around for a long time. She actually doesn't get involved in Huntington's disease until quite late in our timeline. But then she puts on her historian's hat and goes into this community in Venezuela and tries to track the disease in Venezuela, and guess what she discovers? Brought to the community by a 16th century sailor. All right, so there we have our voyages of conquest by our colonial empires, also being voyages that sometimes brought devastation to, biological devastation to communities. So that was kind of an interesting use of her historical understanding. I'll say one more thing about the history, because it is kind of interesting. Here in the U.S., once it was identified as a heredity disorder, it really played into the whole eugenics movement that we had in the United States. Many of us are not aware that around 1910, we had this huge eugenics movement in the United States. A eugenics record office was established by Charles Davenport, who's the scientist who founded Cold Spring Harbor, which is a very important national lab. It's a very prominent national lab now. But back then, it had a eugenics record office. And the idea, I think you remember the Victorian age when you wanted to have fit, you wanted to have healthy and fit bodies. And so there was this movement to try to get rid of unfit people, including people with Huntington's disease. So back in 1910, they started recording names of families. Which during that period, of course, was bad, because there was legislation going on in that regard, and what have you. But later on, that data turned out to be useful for the research community. So the story of HD is also tied to the story of eugenics in the United States.
I don't know what eugenics means.
In terms of eugenics is sort of a deliberate effort to purify the gene pool of the race. So not the Nazi movement was the eugenics movement, which apparently my law student husband over here tells me it has a connection to the U.S. Would you like to say a word about that case?
One of the states, one of the Eastern Seaboard states, had passed legislation for allowing for the forced sterilization of mentally retarded. And that case was called Buck versus Bell. If any of you are interested in looking it up sometime, it was. What's interesting about it is it was eventually overturned by the Supreme Court, but it served as a model for the Nazi legislation which was formalized as part of their eugenics movement.
So the Nazis' ideas of eugenics came out of the U.S.
At least a legislative prerogative. They looked at our legislation as a model. And so that's kind of a darker side.
And where did the U.S.'s, where did this idea grow from? The scientific community or the government? Or?
Well, I think it was both a social and a scientific policy.
They tried to defend it, these forced sterilizations on, the public good argument that, limited resources, we have to control this, and blah, blah, blah. Of course, that argument failed ultimately. But in the meanwhile, Nazis picked it up and used it as a model.
So there is more and more work being done to look at this history in the United States at the current moment. So anyway, Huntington's disease is tied to a lot of important events here, important and not so good events in this country. So I just bring this up to really bring up the issue of disease in society, and we could substitute, what about if we took out the word HD and put in AIDS, right? There's been a lot of, early on there was a lot of discussion about, I'm sure it wasn't quite restricting immigration, but I'm sure there was probably somebody who thought about that and wanted to try to legislate immigration policies having to do with it.
It indeed happened, didn't it?
Did it?
Haiti, yeah. Haitian.
Oh, really? That's right. So I guess sometimes it seems as if we don't learn too much from history, right? Sometimes we don't know the history, so it's hard to learn it when we don't know it. But sometimes we don't learn too much from history. All right, so that's a little bit about some early stuff related to HD. I want to go back and pick up our more contemporary story. And here is where this story is very much like the Lorenzo's Oil story, because again, we get an example of a heroic effort on the part of the families connected with people who have the disorder. Remember, in Lorenzo's Oil, it's Lorenzo's father, who's an economist, and his mother, who's a PhD linguist, who go off and learn the biochemistry so that they can understand and actually come up with a therapy for their son. And here again, we have another example of another family, which changes their life's direction and really puts an enormous effort into moving towards improving our understanding of this disease. So I want to tell you a little bit about this particular family's effort. Remember, at this point, we still have no test for the disease, and we have no therapy. So there's a lot of work that still needed to be done, and actually it's not until 1983 where we get somewhat of a genetic test. It happens to not be a test that everyone can use, but it's the first available test at all that we begin to have for this disease. So there was a lot of room for making headway. And so this family effort begins with actually Milton himself, and as I understand it from the book, his motivation, of course, is his concern for his daughters, because already his ex-wife is slowly deteriorating from the disease. He knows that each of his daughters has a 50-50 chance, so he's very interested in seeing that a test is developed and better treatment is developed. He is a psychologist by training, although he starts out in law school. He goes to law school, and then he starts reading psychology texts in law school. He gets a degree in psychology and spends a lot of time out in Topeka, Kansas at the Menninger Clinic. I don't know if those of you in psychology recognize that clinic. Apparently it was a very important place in terms of its organization and in terms of its work ethic. And now that I'm talking about it, perhaps it was a lot like Holden Village, I don't know. Milton describes, brainstorming sessions and this sort of free flow of ideas, and it sounds like a very active clinic. Anyway, it was very important in his understanding about how people work creatively. And so what he does is he goes to the library and he checks out the textbooks on molecular biology, genetics, and biochemistry. And he himself goes back and tries to pick up the basic science so that he can make a move towards pushing the research community. All right, which I guess as a biochemistry professor, it heartens me to see that people from other fields can pick up the book and they can learn it, If only I could convince my students that it was that an easy an activity. But he takes this on for himself, and what he does is he starts working with the disease foundations. Often with genetic disorders, you get these lay foundations of the families who become active in raising money, being supportive, that kind of thing. But his interest is always in raising money for research, because he knows that, you know, therein lies the test or the therapy. And early in his effort, he's on the West Coast. He combines his effort with Marjorie Guthrie on the East Coast. Remember, Woody Guthrie himself died of Huntington's disease. But they have a big blow up, and that's chronicled in the book. So if you want to know what Marjorie Guthrie's like, you can read about their big blow up. She's more interested in families and support, and he's more interested in research. So he goes off and develops a research foundation where he begins to hold small workshops modeled on what he learned about brainstorming and creativity at the Menninger Clinic. And so he does this kind of radical thing in the science community. He brings together clinicians, young researchers like postdocs, you know, folks who really haven't got their careers established yet and are looking for hot projects and are young and creative and have a lot of energy, can work 80 hours a week in the lab, I don't know. But anyway, he brings people who don't ordinarily talk together, he brings them together. And in addition, he also makes sure that every workshop they hold starts with having a representative from an HD family come in. So, I mean, can you imagine a basic scientist meeting a family who's got the disorder that they're working on? I mean, it's really rare that this kind of thing happens in basic science. So it's probably an early example of sort of the more activist bent that we see with families now and with people who have disease. Diseases that aren't being worked on enough, I'm thinking of the AIDS activists. This predates that, so I think this is probably an early example of that. So he's off doing this. I have to bring in some more characters, and that's Nancy. Guess how Nancy has handled her at-risk status. She's gone off and gotten a PhD in clinical psychology. I guess what her thesis is on? Living with the risk of HD. She works with HD families in Ann Arbor, where she got her PhD. And the basis of her dissertation becomes the article that's entitled Genetic Russian Roulette, The Experience of Being at Risk for HD. Right. So I personally think that she's sort of dealing with being at risk by getting actively involved. Alice, on the other hand, is doing exactly the opposite. She wants nothing to do with other people who have HD. She doesn't want to talk about it. She doesn't want to hear her sister talk about it. She's really sort of gone off in the other direction. All right, so we have Alice, who's living her life. She goes to Latin America and gets a PhD in history, and I mean, just a completely different direction, with Nancy and Milton now working hard in this disorder. In 1972, another kind of event, a pivotal event occurs, and this happens in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm from, which astonishes me that anything this is in Columbus, Ohio. But apparently it does. It's a big international symposium where they bring together people from across the world who are working on this disease. And one thing that happens in this conference is that, once again, clinicians and researchers are introduced to this community, this isolated community in Venezuela. And now what's happening is sort of the genetics technology is gearing up, and so it's kind of a unique moment in history when the geneticists realize in this community they have the possibility for isolating the gene. And so now all the research, a great deal of the research is directed towards finding the gene, with the idea of A, you could get a test, and B, if you had a gene, you could better understand the disease and you could get better therapy. So in 1972, we get this direction towards doing genetics research. So I happen to have a NOVA show on genetic diseases, and right smack in the middle of this is a trip to Venezuela. So I thought, what better way to introduce you to how you do genetic analysis than to actually show you this tape. So let me just set up this clip just a little bit. Nancy Wexler will be in the tape. She'll talk about how you do the test, which I think is kind of interesting. But you'll also get to see the community, and this in itself, of course, raises some important issues that these isolated folks are going to donate blood samples and tissue samples so that way back here in the U.S. we can come up with a test. So we'll talk about some ethical issues here.
In the spring of every year since 1979, an American-led and funded expedition has set off for a remote corner of this huge inland sea 10 degrees north of the equator. The expedition leader is Dr. Nancy Wexler, president of the Hereditary Disease Foundation, which was endowed in memory of her mother, who died of Huntington's disease. The gene Dr. Wexler is tracking down with such passion is the gene that killed her mother and causes the lingering and undignified death of 1,000 other Americans a year. Their destination is a small village perched on stilts over a shallow lagoon. This community has been modified by a few gifts from the high-tech world elsewhere, notably the Japanese-built outboard motor. But there is no fast food, no air conditioning, and no medical care whatsoever. The diet, the culture, and the way of life revolve around one commodity: fish. Another fact of life here is the scourge of Huntington's disease. A single woman brought it to this area in the 1880s. The gene is dominant. Inheriting it from only one parent is sufficient to give the disease. And the random shuffling of the chromosomes over the generations since has distributed the disease to some 1,000 people in this region. Nobody in this village is without many relatives who suffer from it. And because the symptoms rarely appear until quite late in life, these people are condemned to live 40 years in the knowledge that genetic fate may have dealt them a very bad hand. And as the 40-year-old child of a victim herself, Nancy Wexler understands that predicament from a very personal point of view.
Each child of a parent with a disorder has a 50-50 risk of inheriting the disease. So I have a 50-50 risk of inheriting it. My sister has her own 50-50 risk of inheriting it. And there is no way at the moment to tell, there has been no way to tell who is carrying the lethal gene until you actually develop the symptoms of the disease. It causes uncontrollable movements in all parts of the body. It causes massive personality changes, often severe depression, suicidal depression, sometimes hallucinations, delusions. It causes cognitive decline, but patients have still very good insight into the fact that they are slowly and progressively losing all of their faculties. It's invariably fatal, and as of yet, there's no effective treatment.
Every day while she's here, Wexler sets off in search of missing links in the vast family tree that she and her colleagues have compiled over 6 years. The interlinked families of this region are a research goldmine. Thanks to data collected here, the Huntington's disease gene has already been linked to a marker on chromosome number 4 that inherits with the gene 95% of the time. And this has already given a way of predicting, for this family, who has the bad gene. Nancy Wexler explains how, using another imaginary family tree.
Imagine that these dominoes here are people. The black ones have Huntington's disease. In fact, this one has died of this disease. The white ones here are unaffected. And these are three children who want to know what their fate will be. Each one of these children has two chromosome cores, one from mother, one from father. And they have a different DNA pattern on each chromosome core. In this case, you don't know which pattern came from which parent. You can see that these two children have the same patterns, this one has a little different one. The question for these children is, each of them has a 50-50 risk, which is going to get the disease? If you have the parents, you can see what patterns they have. The healthy mother has a four-point pattern on each of her chromosome four. So all she can do is pass on the healthy four-point pattern to her children, which she has done right here. The question is, which of these two patterns in the sick father is sitting next to his Huntington's disease gene? You need to look at another generation. Luckily, that mother's still alive. His father has died of the disease, so his genetic information is unavailable to us. Mother has a two-point pattern on each of her chromosome fours. So the two-point pattern has to be the healthy pattern, because she didn't have the Huntington's gene. So the two-point pattern went to him, this was his healthy chromosome four, and he gave this healthy chromosome four to these two children, so in fact, these two children are free. The five-point pattern has to be sitting next to the Huntington's disease gene. So in giving his five-point pattern to this child here, this child will develop Huntington's disease.
It takes no great expertise to see that common Soto is a black domino. The neurological tests are not for diagnosis, but to record the progress of the disease since last year. Carmen is a direct descendant of the original carrier, and she married another Huntington's victim. So her offspring, with two black dominoes stacked against them, have a 75% chance of getting the disease. Dora is one of Carmen's daughters. She's at the age when every time your eyelid twitches or you drop something, you worry that it's the onset of what they call here el mal. The blood and skin samples she is now consenting to give will tell an expert half a world away what her fate is. But Dora will not get the news. Even if she tests positive for the bad gene, that would not be a diagnosis. There's a 5% chance of error, and there's no treatment to offer, especially in this remote region. It's a major ethical problem which needs to be resolved, since many experts believe predictive tests will have at least as much impact on medicine as gene therapy. In this case, the researchers have decided for the time being to keep the information contained in these gifts of skin and blood to themselves. In a race against deterioration from the tropical heat, the samples are flown to the lab of Dr. James Gazella at Massachusetts General Hospital. Technicians immediately begin the process of chemically chopping up the chromosomes, looking for a closer marker. Somewhere among these fragments of Venezuelan DNA is their ultimate goal, the gene itself. And that could be found in two ways. Either find out what it does or how mistakes in it cause the disease, or track it down so tightly with these methods that you can find it and decode it. Either way, Dr. Gazella cannot promise gene therapy for Huntington's disease.
It's extremely hard to predict whether it's a candidate or not because it depends totally on what the defect is. If the defect is the production of something that is toxic, it's very unlikely that putting in a good copy of the gene is going to eliminate that production. Other techniques, which also involve gene therapy, are, however, being developed to eliminate activities of genes that are present, and those could then be used. If, however, the defect is the absence of production of some protein, then it is a potential candidate for gene therapy.
Meanwhile, does the success of this project offer any hope to Nancy Wexler personally?
Absolutely, but not immediately. to look at a family and see whether or not a person has the marker, which says that the gene is there. You have to have enough of these relatives to look at. And unfortunately, in my family, everyone was wiped out by the disease. So for me personally, it will take the actual discovery of the gene itself to be able to do a diagnosis for me and for my sister. But there are ways that we can now tell if a fetus is carrying the chromosome 4, say from my mother, in which case the fetus would have a 50-50 risk like I do, or from my father, in which case the fetus has no risk because he's not carrying the gene. So it's possible for me and for other people who don't have sufficient family, it is possible to give us some information about the health of future generations.
Well, that part of the story ends. Questions or comments? Issues that little clip raises, boy.
They were actually taking skin samples there?
Yeah.
But you could tell something from the skin that you couldn't tell from blood?
You know, I don't know what the technical answer to that is. I know they get DNA out of both of those kinds of samples. So they probably just want to make sure they, it's like a control, that they're sure that they got both kinds of DNA. And they spent years going, and they still go down there. And they have this massive pedigree. It's probably one of the best pedigrees from a geneticist's point of view that's ever been assembled. Because it's 1,000 people that really have the disorder. And this is called a classical linkage analysis. I don't know if people are familiar with the technology. Other questions or comments? I think there's some important ethical issues, you know, about lack of medical care.
Do you know how long it took them, or how they were explaining to these people what they wanted to do, and how they got, did they get a collective yes or something?
It's well, you saw her with the thumbprint, she was giving her consent, but exactly what was into that consent, I don't know. Other comments?
Yeah, on the film clip.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
No, I have something else.
Something else? Is now a good time to raise your question, or shall I finish the story about the research here?
Story.
Let me bring you up to date on. So they began this, they said, in the late 70s, and the reason why they could start to make these trips was that Nancy herself had gone to work for the federal government. And she became head of a commission on neurodegenerative disorders. What she did very cleverly was she got the project going by using her office paperclip fund. And then she got a new boss who came in who said, you know, you really probably ought to go through the peer review process. You can't get a bigger grant. But it was her own efforts in Washington that really got things going and got this huge project off the ground. Once they got these samples back to the Massachusetts General Lab, it was a very short time afterwards that they got the marker, which gets you close to the gene. And so at this point, the whole HD community, all the researchers, you know, they're very excited. You know, to move in and get a positive result as quickly as they did is often unheard of in science. So there was this great kind of enthusiasm that, you know, the door was going to be closed on this one real soon. But then what happened was they had to go and find the gene. And they started looking for the gene in 1984 by forming a collaborative research project. 7 different research labs decided that they would come together and pool their resources. Now, in science, this is really, in biology in particular, this is really phenomenal that you could get people to agree to share their research. And so this story is also a story of sort of new things happening in science. And these 7 research groups come together, and they have yearly meetings down in Key West. And all the postdocs and the technicians get to go, you know. So you can imagine that there's a lot of, again, it's kind of trying to nourish that and support that creativity. And it turns out in the hunt for the gene, it was very important that there was a collaborative group who could offer each other moral support, because it took them 9 years to find the gene. It was one of the earliest hunts for a gene. You know, it would be a bit like going out into the wilderness here in Holden without a map and without a trail. I mean, they just really were, they were breaking new ground, and it took them a long, long time. But eventually in 1993, they did find the gene itself. And once you have the gene now, you don't have to have the pedigree. So you don't have to, you don't have to have a large pedigree. So that's made testing quite a bit easier. All right, so let me just say a word about genetic testing, because genetic testing in HD has been the groundbreaking area for kind of laying out some of the issues. And so genetic testing starts in this period around 1983, and a test becomes available internationally quite readily. And what people begin, what people who are trying to offer the test begin to discover is that there are some people who just don't want to know. That as long as there's not a therapy, and as long as you don't know when you're going to get it, you know, what good, you know, maybe if you're not going to have any kids, or you've already had your kids, or, you know, but there's a whole group of people who decide not to take it. They don't want to know. On the other hand, there's also a group who do want to know, and they want to get their life in order, right? They want a plan. They want some certainty. So in this particular disorder, when it comes to the testing, it really seems to break down along the lines of, can you live with the uncertainty, or do you need, do you personally feel in your situation you need some certainty? So it's been kind of interesting to see how genetic testing has gone with this disorder. So let me just finish the story by telling you that the gene is found in 1993. Here it is, 1998, we still have no treatment. We still do not understand about this disease. That what they found out about the gene is that the protein that it codes for is an abnormal protein, and it tacks on this one particular building block several times. It repeats it several times. It's called a CAG repeat disease. And what's interesting about it is they now know that there are other neurodegenerative and genetic disorders that have the same kind of what's called the CAG repeat. So that's been kind of interesting to see that there are some other situations. But still, they still, every year I go to the literature to see how it's working out. And you find one paper which says, well, it's this that's going on. You find another paper which says it's this that's going on. So really, they're not much closer to understanding the disease. And so at that point, if you have a test but you don't have therapy, it's not terribly useful, but... So I think that's where I'll end the HD story.
Is it related to multiple sclerosis?
Some of the kinds of MD disorders, muscular dystrophy disorders, have this CAG repeat. It's very interesting biochemically, but even though it's interesting biochemically, it doesn't help people yet. So.
They spoke in the film about gene therapy.
In the case of this particular disease, strict gene therapy of putting in a new gene and taking out is not going to work because you'll always have that bad gene working. So any kind of gene therapy they have to do would have to do at the regulatory end. And as far as I know, they haven't been able to do that yet.
What does that mean, regulatory end?
It has to do with your genes. So let me just explain that notion. So first of all, let's take a biological perspective on you and realize that you're made of 4 trillion cells, roughly 4 trillion cells, right? In each one of those cells, you have the same piece of DNA, right? And that piece of DNA that's yours is roughly about a meter in length. If you take all your chromosomes and you unravel them and you stitch them from end to end, they'll be a meter in length. So that's kind of interesting. How do you get a molecule that's this long crammed into your, like a cell, which is 20 micrometers in diameter? That's the wow part of biochemistry, right?
Oh, skin.
Yeah, right. So here's the problem. Each one of your cells has the same piece of DNA. But presumably, your brain cells, for example, are nothing like your big toe cells, right? As far as we know, we're not doing any thinking down there, right? As far as we know. So what that means is you have to have your brain DNA, your brain genes turned off in the big toe cell, and you have to have your big toe cell DNA genes turned off in your brain, right? So there's this whole thing about your your DNA has to be regulated. So there's on and off switches. So if they could genetically turn off this bad gene, put in the new gene, then theoretically, very theoretically, they would have therapy. But all of that is still...
And a gene is just a spot.
A part of the DNA, right.
So how many genes?
Let's see.
To get the magnitude of how hard
right.
it is to find this.
Your meter of DNA is composed of 3 billion building blocks.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And in that 3 billion, it's a really small number. I think it's something like less than, I don't want to misquote myself.
It's okay.
It's something like less than 10% is genetic material that codes for proteins. We carry around a lot of what they used to call junk DNA. And of course, they called it junk because they didn't know what it was doing. But now we know better not to insult our DNA by calling it junk. Yeah.
Are we doing a general question?
Sure.
Okay. This probably fits into the cultural, maybe the organizational. As I've understood it, the disease control comes from first identifying and then quarantining. I'm thinking of the eugenics right
here.
As I've heard both of you speak, it seems like your lips kind of curl down when you say eugenics, that it's bad. I guess I have several questions. Is quarantine part of eugenics and controlling the gene pool?
Well, you can't just pick up these bad genes. They have to come through your pedigree. So why would you quarantine?
Disease portions of the population
right.
out of the body.
Right, so they wouldn't marry
sterilizations,
something like that.
Mm-hmm. So exactly.
I mean, I think you're taking a very unpopular stance here, but I agree with that, stopping these kinds of things. I was all for the ban on people with AIDS coming into the country. It's just, having a lot of uncontrolled disease being spread out, which has indeed happened. I think in an earlier century that people were not having as much free sex or, doing things that would spread, but we have a lot of sperm donor babies and people that pass on diseases knowingly and not caring and just spreading that out. And I would like to see quarantines. I think it's become politically very unpopular. When I was a youngster, some of you too probably see the polio signs on houses and make sure that this disease was not being spread, but I have not seen a quarantine sign anywhere for the past 20 years.
I guess what I would say first of all, it would very, very much depend on what the disorder is. Because there are some genetic diseases that are very mild. For example, spina bifida. It's a disorder that can range from very mild to very severe.
Yes.
So you want to take these people, and these people in this community will tell you that they live perfectly rich lives.
Yes.
So to try to condemn them, I think we wouldn't want to do.
And it's a serious proposition to start talking about depriving individuals of their liberty interests, in the name of... Is it an imminent threat to the public at large? A lot of times we don't know. We don't know how these diseases are transmitted. For example, with the AIDS example, I can remember it wasn't that long ago where they were saying, well, if somebody with AIDS just breathes on you or touches you, you can contract the disease. Of course, now we know that it takes a lot more than that to contract AIDS. And so, there are some serious issues about depriving people of their liberty.
When it comes to a hideously dangerous disease like Ebola, is there still a question there? Or do we say we have found a place to draw the line and for sure we will not let those people run around freely?
I can't tell you exactly where the line is, but I would guess that there would probably have to be some imminent danger to the public. They would have to say that, we know that this is a smallpox outbreak or influenza was, I think they used some degree of quarantines with some of those outbreaks where they knew how it was transmitted and they knew it was a public safety measure, to control it.
And I can think of another argument too. Recently, it was shown that cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease, which until very recently there wasn't a good therapy, and people who got the disease died at age 20, for example. But now there's a good therapy; they can live longer. But recently, just last week before last, the last time I read a newspaper, there was a report that carrying the cystic fibrosis trait gives you resistance to typhoid. So if we go around messing, sometimes we're going to have to be really careful with how we mess with these genetic disorders. Because if we now quarantine everyone who carries cystic fibrosis, we're going to probably raise the risk for typhoid. So, I think there's a lot that we don't know, a whole lot we don't know about our bio.
But to kind of summarize that we have to be very careful where we draw that line. But there are pieces where we do put it on the far side of the line and say, you don't have rights to do whatever you want to do.
Well, probably for very highly contagious diseases, there'd be a reach a point where the public interest would outweigh the individual liberty interest of that person.
Yes.
Yeah. That would be up to the court. Ultimately, that would be up to the courts to more likely to draw that line and make a decision and say.
You had a comment?
Well, as someone that visibly, hospitals quarantine all the time. When in case of someone that has, and in the case of Ebola or something of that nature.
Right away.
Right away.
Right.
But sometimes there's just hysteria involved and stereotyping of certain races or whatever. And in the case of genetics, those are transmitted differently through the heredity. So
the only thing you do by quarantining in the case of genetics, I want to assure you that you can't catch a genetic disease. You can't catch a genetic disease. Now, if you marry somebody who is a carrier of a disease or a dominant disease and you have kids, then there's a possibility you pass it down to your kids.
Yes.
You cannot catch a genetic disease.
True, yeah. I think of future generations, me today.
Just so we clarify.
That's a case of identifying it earlier on.
Right.
One of the genetic example I can think of is the people that we met from the small people of America. They call them, they were dwarfs, essentially. And they had a whole plethora of health risk, health problems associated with the genes that they carry. But they advocated very strongly that, hey, we have healthy, we do enjoy life, we're not perfect, but we are people, we have rights. And, where do you stop, Do you start saying, well, this couple's going to produce a deaf child or a blind child, and there were people there with problems like that. Yeah, they were deaf, blind, and they were just like, "Hey, if I want to have kids and they might be blind or deaf, that's our business," So it's kind of just really touchy.
Any other comments about this issue or another issue? We've got a little bit more time here.
I would have 60 Minutes did something on this a couple of years ago.
1986.
I don't know if it was the Wexler family, but it seemed to be with sisters. And first there wasn't the test, and then there was. And it's like, did one choose to take it and one didn't? Or they both took it, but one didn't want to know or something like
right.
that.
Right. Nancy took the test, but refused to reveal to the public what the result was.
Okay.
And as far as we know, Alice never took the test.
Okay.
My students always want to know.
Is anyone following the families? You said that there was a group of people who wanted to know and a group of people who didn't want to know. Is there some sort of research following those families?
Right, there's been a lot of research on the testing and who takes it and why they take it. Because it was really the first genetic test. So it was really a pivotal work. So I'm sure that people are still. There's a whole body of literature out there. I guess I would want to end by just leaving an issue, and that is, this is about a genetic disease, and clearly You know, when you see a disease that it's as devastating as this to families, I mean, it's not just devastating to the person, but to the whole families. Clearly, you know, how can you be against genetic research? How can you be against gene therapy, right? But the problem that's happening very rapidly is now there's this whole category of work in terms of genetics and thinking about genetic enhancement. All right, are we gonna mess with eye color and intelligence and what have you? And so I think it's important to realize, you know, that how are we gonna balance the need to certainly work on disease with kind of the overwhelming, as I said on Thursday night, the overwhelming sort of railroad creek feeling that, you know, corporations are gonna want. I asked my students, you know, how much would you pay to have your children have a certain eye color? And so we kind of worked out as a group, you know, it was kind of surprising how readily they'd be willing to pay for changes in eye color. So, this is at a Lutheran liberal arts college, I should tell you. Yeah.
Hey, hasn't that happened with plastic surgery where initially it was just to undo the hideous damage that was done in accidents?
That's a good example.
People like to reshape their bodies, their faces, and turn into monsters.
Yeah, I think the danger in this case is we don't know what we're doing when we mess with genes.
Now, you use the word mess. Is there a bias when you say that?
Obviously. and I'll just tell you, our DNA expert on Thursday night, Shirsty, tried to assure us that the human organism is so complex that that no scientist is ever going to be able to figure it out. I hope that's true. But I'll leave you with an example of what happens when you mess with DNA. You know maize, the variegated corn maize, Indian corn?
Mm-hmm.
All those different colors are due to DNA rearrangements. Okay? So it kind of happens randomly when the DNA rearranges what's going to turn out. So if we start putting in DNA, you know, what are we going to do that we're not checking for? All right? And I'll leave with one final example because I'm running past my time. Early on in the agricultural field, with animals, there was the idea that if you put the growth hormone in animals, you get bigger animals. So I heard about an experiment with pigs where you put the growth hormone in and you hope that you're going to get more bacon. Right? And what they discovered in this particular experiment was that the pigs stayed the same as without the gene, same weight. And they noticed that the pigs were crankier. So their purpose was to have the pigs grow big, but somehow the way they did their particular experiment, the pigs grew cranky and they grew bigger. So to me that's another isolated case of, you know, we don't know what we're gonna get. So I always tell my students, I'm going to be very careful about letting anybody mess with my anyway, we need to end. So,
thank you.
Interesting.